What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care. So sit back, relax, and defocus.
Hey, everybody. It's time for the Defocus Media Podcast. And in honor of January being Glaucoma Awareness Month, we thought it was time to talk about what's going on in glaucoma because a lot of new things happened at the end of 2017, kind of right when we were going through the normal madness of the last 2 weeks of 2017 in optometry. And so it might have kind of gone under the radar what two new medications got approved. But there's also a lot of new surgical techniques and options that are going to be potentially coming out in the near future. To talk about this topic in full, we decided to bring in a very qualified guest. He's one of the prominent glaucoma specialists in our area in North Carolina, where Daryl and I both practice. Welcome to the show, Dr. Thomas Hunter.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for your time today. Why don't we start off just by telling the audience about yourself and how you chose glaucoma as your specialty in ophthalmology?
Sure. I'm Dr. Thomas Hunter. I am an ophthalmologist at Duke University. My specialty is cataract and glaucoma surgery. I went to the University of Tennessee, Memphis for medical school. Then I did my residency training at Howard University Hospital, followed by my glaucoma specialty training at Duke University Hospital. As far as why I went into glaucoma, a lot of complex reasons why I went into glaucoma. First, glaucoma is the number one cause of vision loss, irreversible vision loss in the world. There's greater than 2.5 million people in the United States with glaucoma, and it is the number one cause of irreversible blindness in African Americans in the United States. You know, my first exposure to glaucoma treatment came in my residency training under Dr. Leslie Jones, who's a glaucoma specialist at Howard University Hospital. While working with her, I did find that glaucoma management was the most challenging of pretty much all the specialties in ophthalmology. I think a lot of the residents felt that way as well. Just the diagnosis of glaucoma, doing gonioscopy, the adherence to the medications, the surgeries that were performed, the post-op management, early, late complications, just caused a lot of stress, you know, in residency in the treatment of glaucoma. So I found that to be just the most challenging. So for me, it was pretty easy. Also, glaucoma management allowed me to continue to do cataract surgery. My alternate passion was cataract surgery, and going into a glaucoma specialty allowed me to continue to do high quality cataract surgery as well as high quality glaucoma care. So for me, it's more of a passion. I love it to be able to take care of these patients who are going blind, to help them prevent them from going blind. Is a pleasure and an honor.
I agree really well with what you just said about how glaucoma was probably one of the most challenging specialties that you could go into in ophthalmology. The communication and the collaboration between you as a doctor and the patient is the most demanding because all the success rides on the patient understanding their treatment plan and actually abiding by it and having compliance. So it's something that you can't physically do everything to take care of them there in the office that day. They have to understand everything and do their part at home. And that makes it so much harder because you need that really good patient communication to give that success.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, the communication. Actually, when I first see any time I'm referred a patient for glaucoma treatment or just to evaluate for glaucoma, I would say most of the time I spend with the patient is actually talking to the patient about just what glaucoma is, you know, just so they have a clear understanding of what they're doing or what it is, what we're evaluating for when it comes to treatments. Do they have a clear understanding of the medications, the drops they need to go into their eyes, how to put the medications into their eyes is also very, very important. So again, it's a lot of things that revolves around good glaucoma management.
So let's take it from the beginning. Let's start with the basics. Outside of the doctor-patient communication, what are the basic needs or equipment that we should have in office to be able to treat glaucoma? Because there's been a lot of innovations out there lately. What should we start with if we're trying to start a glaucoma specialty practice?
Oh, yeah. The equipment that I use the most, so for all my patients who come in for evaluations, they need pachymetry. You know, central corneal thickness is a big risk factor for the development of glaucoma. You know, visual field testing, also done at every visit for new glaucoma evaluations, looking for any type of visual field loss. I primarily use OCTs to look at the nerve fiber layer. There's other equipment like HRTs, which are also useful. Again, I primarily use the OCT to monitor for nerve fiber layer progression, you know, and I would say those are the big ones right now. The pachymeter, visual field, stereo disc photography, also very important. Being able to document and monitor the disc and actually look at it, compare it to previous testing, is people think that it's lost, but it's really not. You know, I still do a high volume of stereo disc photography, looking for changes there as well. You want to be able to detect change early before they lose vision. So all of these testing modalities helps you to detect glaucoma at its earliest.
Now, I wanted to circle back on something that you touched on. It's a word that I hated when I was in optometry school, and it was gynoscopy. How often are you doing that?
About 1,000 times a day.
Ooh, man. Jennifer, how often are you doing that in your practice when you're looking at your glaucoma patients?
So, and Dr. Hunter, you can correct me if you disagree with this. I want to do it once a year, at least. The angle needs to be proven to be open if I'm treating open angle glaucoma. So I consider it something as part of, definitely part of their yearly diagnostics glaucoma evaluation.
No, that is correct. You know, I get a lot of glaucoma suspect evaluations. Gonioscopy really helps you to, one, diagnose an open angle versus a closed angle type of glaucoma, but all the secondary forms of glaucoma. You know, so you can look at an angle, you can look at the eye and it can look open, but then you can look into the angle and see increased pigmentation in specular meshwork, makes you think of a pigment dispersion kind of syndrome. You can find, you know, plateau iris or other conditions of the angle that really helps you to guide your management. And so So for my glaucoma suspects, they all get it to kind of classify what type of glaucoma they have. And then I do it once a year just to monitor, especially if they still have cataracts, because as patients get older, their cataracts progress. And as they progress, they can, even if they were open at one point, they can start to narrow off. And so you want to monitor for that. So yeah, once a year after that.
So let's talk about the two new medications that got approved right at the tail end of 2017 for primary open angle glaucoma. First one up is Vizulta. It is a prostaglandin combined with a nitric oxide medication used once nightly. Tell me a little bit about where you think that medication might fall into your treatment regimen. And do you feel like that it is an improvement over prostaglandin alone?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Prostaglandins right now, such as latanoprost, is considered first line treatment. It's what we've been using. It works great at lowering the pressure inside the eye. And so with the new medications, the Xyvolta, it adds in the element of nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is a potent vasodilator in the body and in the trabecular meshwork. It can help to open up the trabecular meshwork to allow better outflow and lower the pressure in the eye. But in glaucoma patients, nitric oxide in the aqueous humor is decreased. And so that trabecular meshwork, which is the highest, the primary site of resistance in glaucoma and high pressure glaucomas, adding this nitric oxide helps to allow better flow through the trabecular meshwork. And so far, you know, all of the phase 3 studies have shown to have a better efficacy and lower pressure than timolol and latanoprost. So I'm excited about it. You know, cost is always an issue with medications. Also, one of the challenges we face. As long as patients are able to get the medication, I think it could definitely give us that extra boost that we need and that little extra drop. You know, sometimes it all takes is a millimeter or two of mercury of drop in intraocular pressure to give us a little bit extra better control and prevent glaucoma progression. So I would definitely use it when it becomes available, more readily available and cost effective.
I think, you know, poised potentially to be the new first line treatment, as long as, like you said, cost effectiveness. And then you've got Repressa that came out just right before the year ended, which is, again, a novel glaucoma treatment with a Rho kinase inhibitor. But instead of first line, they're kind of promoting this as more of an adjunct drop that you would use as a second addition drop. Let's talk a little bit about what do you think about that medication and its possible efficacy.
Well, Ropressa is one of the newer medications out. It's a Rho kinase inhibitor. It also has another mechanism where it's a norepinephrine transport inhibitor. This medication, it gives you multiple different mechanisms to lower the pressure. It can increase your trabecular meshwork outflow. It can lower aqueous production by increasing norepinephrine in the eye. And kind of a newer thing is that it decreases episcleral venous pressure, which is awesome. Not a lot of medications out there are going to decrease episcleral venous pressure. And this gives us for the first time a possibility of getting pressures maybe even a little bit lower. Typically, episcleral venous pressure is around 8 to 12. And now we may be able to get it down by using this down lower than 8, which would be, again, great in our severe glaucoma patients. Most of the studies out, you know, at least by itself, showed it to have better efficacy in low tension glaucoma patients rather than the high pressures. I don't think it outperformed timolol and high pressure glaucomas. So for that reason, you know, it's not going to be a first line treatment, but just an adjunct. But they are, you know, there are some combinations that are not available in the U.S. right now, but there are some combination medications out there where they're combining Ropressa with latanoprost to give us that fourth, you know, mechanism of increasing uveal scleral outflow. And again, I think they offer that maybe in Japan and other places like that, but not available here. But when they combine these two medications, you know, because again, low pressure glaucoma is also highly, highly prevalent in the USA. And, you know, now you have a medication that treats that the best. Adding it with latanoprost should give us a very well, you know, controlled balance of pressure control, highs and lows.
I know that's kind of how I've been feeling about it. When I was reading the articles, I was like, okay, all this stuff about Ropressa and how it should work on lower pressure. I mean, that sounds really promising, but like, I just want the rock latan. Like whenever that comes out, it's just like gearing me up to think, okay, Ropressa, great. Give me the rock latan. That's what I really want.
That's right. I want just put them together and let's call it a day.
So in addition to drops, let's talk about some surgeries. I mean, I know you're kind of a rock star when it comes to probably getting some of those residents out of trouble. Let's talk about some of the surgeries that you perform and what techniques or procedures are out there for various types of glaucoma.
Oh yeah. Right now, primary surgeries for, you know, intraocular surgeries. Well, let's start with the laser surgeries first. So we have laser surgeries that we can do inside the office, iridotomies, iridoplasties, trabeculoplasties are the major laser surgeries that I'm performing. The surgeries in the operating room, we have the new, it's not really new, but the Express Mini Glaucoma shunt to me is definitely an advantage over standard trabeculectomy. And it's still my filtering procedure of choice. When that's not working as well as I would like, then we also have glaucoma drainage devices such as the barbell implant, also an amazing shunting device to lower the pressure. But now, you know, I guess over the last few years, a lot of the hype in glaucoma and what's got most of the glaucoma specialists kind of excited are the new MIGS, minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries that are available. There are some really good ones out there. What I've been doing more recently is the Kahook goniotomy blade, as well as the CyPass, which is a suprachoroidal drainage shunt. Both of those procedures can be combined with cataract surgery to treat typically mild to moderate glaucoma. But I've been using, you know, some of those procedures, such as the CyPass, and we're getting really, really low pressures, at least initially. And I think it will have some benefit in treating higher pressure glaucomas. I mean, more severe glaucomas, you know, just because, you know, glaucoma surgery management, it's a spectrum, right? So as far as, you know, you have to look at when a patient was diagnosed and how long they're going to live, right? So sometimes that's, you know, from diagnosis to end of life is 5 years. Sometimes it's 40 years, right? And so we need a lot of different weapons along that path. You know, sometimes it's medications, sometimes it's lasers, sometimes it's surgeries. Now we're throwing, you know, right in the middle of more aggressive surgeries, the MIGS for surgery, some minimally invasive glaucoma surgery, is really giving us that extra time we need to get them through. The goal is to keep the patient seeing all the days of their life. And again, we need as many weapons as we can to get them that far.
So kind of going back, when we think about all these great surgeries that have come out, and some of them really are extremely minimally invasive, even looking at laser procedures like SLT, I know European model versus American model, there's a lot of debate on what should be our first line primary open glaucoma treatment. So in your personal opinion, do you feel like it's worth considering an SLT or a minimally invasive surgery as first line therapy versus starting someone on an eye drop for the rest of their life with compliance issues, with known side effect issues? And where do you fall on that argument?
It's patient specific, right? Some patients can do it. Some patients, as far as I say do it, I mean, using eye medications. So what I prefer, you know, and I always talk to the patient about it, you know, I tell them about medications versus lasers. And when they ask my opinion, I tell them, I prefer you try the medications first. Again, I think the educational part, putting these drops in your eyes needs to be as routine as, you know, washing your face in the morning and brushing your teeth, right? You need to, in some way in your mind, you need to accept the importance of using these drops. And so I really, really do try to get the medications first. I personally, there's an acceptance that comes with glaucoma. You have glaucoma, you have this potentially blinding condition, your optic nerve is deteriorating, and we need to stop it. And I need them to be on board with that. And so I think that using a drop and getting used to using a drop every day helps them to at least accept the condition for what it is. Right. Once they've kind of accepted it, you know, they prove that they can use the medication every day, then I love to use SLT as my second line treatment. They've shown they can use the medication. I don't really always want to add on more and more medications, mainly because of side effects. And so I'll consider, you know, SLT as my second line treatment. Now, there are certain patients who will have challenges with using the medication. It can be everything from arthritis in their hands to just poor adherence. They're just not going to do it. And you'll know that by, you know, after a few visits, you know, whether this patient is somebody who cannot put drops in their eyes. For those patients, I absolutely recommend doing the SLT. The SLT lasts, you know, 2 or 3 years, then it wears off and you have to do it again. The one thing I don't want to happen is for somebody to get a laser and then they think you cured their glaucoma. They go away, then you see them 10 years later and they've lost their vision because they, and somewhere in their mind, they felt as if you cured their glaucoma by doing this laser. And that's the, you know, the main reason why I don't offer it as first line treatment unless I absolutely have to.
That's such a good argument. I've never thought about it from that perspective before. But like we talked about, the biggest hurdle to glaucoma care is collaborating with the patient on their side of the care part of it. And it's an ongoing condition that they have to buy into the treatment. And by bypassing that up front, it might set them up for failure later on. I really like that philosophy behind how you do that. So obviously, as a glaucoma specialist, you're getting a lot of referrals from ODs in the community. Is there anything you kind of frequently see from your referred patients from ODs that you think we should kind of pay more attention to, rethink maybe how we're doing things? Anything that you've noticed that maybe you'd like to see treated a little bit differently within the optometry community?
The thing I'm usually asking for when I get referrals, because most of the patients I'm getting referred to is going to be glaucoma suspects. You know, people toggle on the, you know, maybe there's glaucoma here, maybe there's not glaucoma, kind of get that confirmation. Glaucoma is a disease of progression. And so the thing that I'm always looking for, and the question I'm always asking my patients or calling back to referring doctor for, is what that evaluation looked like 10 years ago, 5 years ago, right? I want to see what somebody thought of how their optic nerve looked, whether it was normal or abnormal, again, as far back as I can get it. So I'll try to just dig deep into the patient's history to find out what people thought. Because if a doctor sees them 10 years ago and says, well, cup to disc ratio 0.1, right? And that's documented 0.1 for many, many years. They've always been seen. And then now they come in and they're 0.5. That's a big difference. You know, all their glaucoma testing may come back normal at a 0.5. But, you know, if clearly they were a 0.1, 5 years ago and they're 0.5 today, that's not something. There's a lot of, you know, inter-doctor variability in describing cup to disc ratios, but that's a difference that not many people are going to just disagree about between a 0.1, 0.5. So I really want to know what their history is. And I work really hard on trying to get old records because patients want to know, do I have glaucoma? Now, if I look at an old record and they thought it was a 0.4 and then today, I think it's a 0.5. There's enough variability in that I made us say that's this monitor. But if I see a big difference in old versus new, I may, even with normal testing, I will likely probably consider putting them on treatment. I really don't want to wait till they start losing vision before we get to before we start treatment.
I think that's a great point. One thing that I would like to bring up, you know, outside of what you just said in regards to optometrists and ophthalmologists co-managing, is what's up with you guys not taking care of dry eyes from these glaucoma drops, man? All my patients that come in that I send to any glaucoma specialist, they're like, no, they never told me that I have dry eyes. No, I shouldn't be using this, that, and third. What's up, man? What's the beef that you guys have with talking to them about dry eye treatment?
They want to get out of the room, Daryl.
I actually talk to my patients about dry eye treatments, you know, it's very, very common that the medications are going to make the eyes more dry. You know, there are a couple of prostaglandins out there that are supposed to help, you know, with that and prevent them from drying out even more, like Travertan Z, which is supposed to have the special preservative in it that reduces the amount of surface irritation. But I give all my patients a list of what I consider to be the best lubricants out there to use. So again, it's a big problem, and they all have my list.
And that's why I refer to you, Dr. Hunter, so all I right. greatly appreciate that.
I did see that very recently in JAMA, there was an article that came out that like showed data of the high percentage of people taking glaucoma medications that have meibomian gland dysfunction. So I've kind of, in my mind, even think like, now before I start any glaucoma treatment, I want to do some meibomian gland imaging and monitor for that too. So
yeah, why not? Why not? I mean, it's they have some great LipaView, which is a new tool we have to look at the meibomian glands. I typically don't do a lot of that. We have in my practice a few of our dry eye specialists at the Duke Eye Center, and so that's typically where I refer my patients to them when I need that specialized meibomian gland testing done.
It's wonderful to have that kind of partnership within, whether it's OD ophthalmology collaboration or MD to MD, OD to OD collaboration, where we think about everything we do to the ocular surface, of course, is going to have some impact. And while even as optometrists will sometimes be like, well, I'm a contact lens specialist, I can't do contact lenses unless I do dry eye. You know, like I can't separate those two things out. So in glaucoma and cataract, dry eye is such a big part of the outcomes of both of those things. So we all have to kind of work together for the total body of the patient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Patient first.
So looking at 2018 now, we're on the breast of a brand new year. Is there anything besides these drops that we've talked about coming out within ophthalmology, within glaucoma treatment, within surgical even options for treating glaucoma that you're super excited about for taking care of patients?
The minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries. I am super excited about that. You know, again, the if these, you know, and then historically, we really haven't been able to find, in my opinion, any really good minimally invasive glaucoma surgeries that are really helping us to prevent from doing trabeculectomies or tube shunt surgeries, which again, I prefer to save until we absolutely have to use them. So I'm super excited about just where that's going. And I really, really do hope that we're able to get a nice reduction, long-term reduction. I don't want something that's just going to last, you know, for a few months and then everything kind of goes back to what it was. And so we just need, and unfortunately, we don't have any long-term data on a lot of these MIGS surgeries that they work long-term. You know, a lot of them are promising within the first few months, and then we kind of drop off. But again, right now, you know, I've been seeing, again, you know, with the CyPass and the Cahook, the two main ones that I do, really, really good results, and I'm very optimistic about them. You know, trabeculectomy has always been the gold standard. You know, glaucoma drainage device is also a standard, you know, a gold standard when we really want to try to get the pressure down low. You know, there's a lot of buzz about whether there's going to be some way to regenerate the optic nerve. You know, it sounds almost a little bit sci-fi, but I do think that it's going to be possible one day. Some animal studies have shown that they're able to do some regeneration. Nothing in human trials, but, you know, we're probably 10, 15, 20 years down the road. But the day that we're actually able to treat the optic nerve itself is when we will have a gold star win in glaucoma. And I just look forward to that day. Patients ask me about it all day long, especially the ones who are going blind. It's like, is there any way to fix the optic nerve? Because they all know that once you lost the vision, once the damage is done, there's no way to reverse the damage. And they want to know, is there anything? And they all say, put me on a list. You know, the second something comes available, I want it. And so so with that, you know, I'm happy that there are people out there doing research and looking at that as a possible mechanism of treatment. And again, I would gladly use it if it ever got to that point where we were able to regenerate the optic nerve.
Well, Dr. Hunter, we greatly appreciate these precious jewels that you dropped on us today. We really do appreciate you joining us for Glaucoma Awareness Month. If any of our followers want to contact you, what's the best social media or email address for them to reach out to you if they have some additional questions?
My Duke email is thomas.g.hunter@duke.edu. So if people want to contact me through my email, then I'm happy with that. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.